Hello everyone, can you hear me? Can you hear me at the back? Brilliant. Okay. I was born in 1957. I was brought up in this house in Shepperton, in London's west suburbs. In 1964, my mother died suddenly on holiday in Spain, and I was 7 years old. I remember her in bed, gasping for breath from a silver oxygen cylinder, overseen by a doctor and my father. Then I recall sitting and defecating on a low chair on the balcony of the apartment overlooking the sea, thinking she was dying. Next, my father took me and my siblings in his arms and said, "She's dead." I went to a cemetery. I watched a coffin descend into a dark hole before being covered with soil. The ground was barren. I recall trying to make supper, a meat stew in the apartment. It was very salty, and I thought, I must learn to cook properly. My father never mentioned my mother again. There were no photos of her on display at home, no possessions, no letters. We moved on with our lives. But the unsaid was said at night. I wetted the bed, I rocked compulsively, and I had terrifying nightmares. I liked drawing, and my father kept this one. In the early 1990s, I retrained and I left art school in 2006. My student work was mostly drawing, and when I drew, I was searching for an emotional feeling, a reverie, that could be termed oceanic. It always inspired by plants. But others had an uncanny charge, a hidden force which needed to be expressed, a disturbance, perhaps triggered by my mother's abrupt death and the family silence. Sometimes I left holes and drew faceless women. There was no mental space to think or ask about my mother. Unthought feelings lay in the artwork. I was feeling an emotion, but I didn't know why. In 2009, my father died, which brought my mother into sharp focus. I began to think and ask, to be curious. My father's probate necessitated obtaining a copy of her death certificate from the Spanish authorities, which gave new information, the dates of her life, the place of her death in El Campello, a village next to Alicante. Clearing my father's home, I discovered photos of my mother that I'd never seen before, and I found a powder compact on my father's writing desk, dating from the early 1960s. I recall my mother using a gold compact to powder her face. I'm being held on a train journey. I'm close to her face, and I can see her powdered, fine, downy hairs catching the sunlight. I didn't draw for 6 months, and when I returned, plants no longer inspired me. I was able to study my mother's face, clothes, shoes, and handbag. I wanted to touch her, to reclaim her, to reinstate her into my life. Through drawing, I was connecting with my mother. I had taken her watch from the bedroom where she died, and I'd kept it hidden. I drew this watch, and I drew the powder compact. I then drew other objects from the house, which held personal significance, and brought them together in my first memory box. The box is about I guess about maybe five or six feet by about 4 or 5 feet. And this is its unframed finish. And then this is an installation shot of it in a gallery. And you can see that there's a vertical panel, which is called an inventory, and it lists the objects. And that's a detail of that inventory. I then made a second memory box of drawings made from memory. These included my mother's Playtex girdle, which I used to reach up and touch. I loved its textured side panel and the smooth satin tummy, as well as the stocking clip. And her swimming cap. I remember her swimming cap well. We used to go swimming together in Sunbury-on-Thames near Shepperton. And her toy dog, she called Max. My brother used to walk around with it dangling near his legs. And my Spanish fan, which she borrowed to cool her fever. Except when I drew it at about at least 2 feet wide, whereas I'm sure the real thing was probably only 6 inches. And I also drew the oxygen cylinder and put them in this memory box. And the oxygen cylinder sits next to the fan in the middle. And there it is. And again, it has an inventory. And that's the inventory, some of the detailed of the inventory. Then I made a third memory box about my father. Here, memories are treasured, preserved behind glass, pinned and ordered, evocative of a museum display and supported by an information panel. I am the curator of my past. Are these memory boxes self-portraits where I'm trying to bring some order to my life, which was broken by the death of my mother? Am I attempting to repair an aspect of myself that was damaged? My mother's two sisters have died, but I visited Auntie Peggy in Stafford with my baby daughter in 1996. She gave me a small black and white photograph of my mother holding me in front of the Sphinx in Chiswick House Gardens. It was a polite exchange, and I filed the print away, feeling that I shouldn't look at it. Clearing my father's study in 2009, I discovered the companion photo and made two large drawings to commemorate this moment caught in time. My mother smiles in front of the Sphinx, the man-eating beast of Thebes, and dies 7 years later. For years, I dreamt of trying to swim through pools filled with excrement or rotting food and rubbish, or of entering pools which were so tiny or shallow it was impossible to move. Perhaps the dreams were telling me there was no space in the family to think about my mother. I became anxious about exhibiting these mother drawings in 2014. Was I betraying my father? The dreams became more frequent, one or two a week. But the exhibition opened, and my world didn't collapse, and the dream stopped, and I haven't had another one since. I then made a series of 24 drawings about childhood memories of my home. Here are openings and corners, places where I might get stuck, but also places to escape into, to block the real world. Door handles, hinges and switches could be transformative, allowing me to open or close, to switch on or off. Memories are no longer ordered together inside a memory box. and the individual drawings can be displayed in any way. In Leeds last year, the curators hung these drawings in a line, and in London and Aldborough, the curators mixed them with another artist's work. After a period of intense drawing, I make unregulated pink watercolours, free from control and order. Could I be exploring the touch of my and my mother's mind and body, where we connect mentally and physically in the early stages of life, when my mother was mediating the environment for me, caring for me? Or could they be aspects of my mother which are contained within me, referring to soft bodily fluids? Last September, the curator Liz Lydiate and I visited Chiswick House Gardens to find the Sphinx. As I looked through my camera lens at the statue, the lines of perspective were different to my parents' photos, and we discovered the statue had been moved to a new place in the garden. After much research, and by enlarging my original prints, we matched a row of Edwardian terraced houses identified in the background, and found the original 1957 location. Etienne Boll, a camera historian, came and looked through a camera from the late 1950s to calculate the exact spot where my parents' photos had been taken. I then stood there and photographed the scenes. So that's the original, obviously. And that's it as you see it today. And these two prints complete an act of family portraiture, which began in 1957. Last October, I wanted to draw the dried up riverbed where I walked with my mother in Spain before she died. Its large mud cracks are etched on my mind. However, when I work, I need to inhabit every drawing. I literally need to climb inside the drawing, otherwise I can't draw. And this creative necessity compelled me to go to Alicante the first time in 52 years. Not knowing where my mother was buried, or if the riverbed still existed, Nieves La Casa, a friend, helped find the cemetery called Our Lady of Remedy, which has records dating back to 1964, as well as the apartment and the riverbed. At the end of October, I flew to Alicante. My mother lies in a grave shared with other women and children. It felt good to lie on the soil above the burial chamber, so close to her. I could imagine her skull a few feet from me. I walked in the Rio Seco, a wide U-shaped riverbed of eroded sandstone. The apartment and the balcony where I had sat looked the same. I imagined our car parked outside in the adjacent scrubland where my brother and I searched for black beetles. Returning to England, I was able to inhabit each drawing as I drew and added text to suggest the passage of time before and after her death. Sorry, missed that one out. How could I respond to these drawings? The word collision came to mind, and I imagined horizontal pencil lines travelling towards each other. I made a small study to test the idea, but I didn't like it because I couldn't breathe. So I introduced a rule that didn't allow the lines to touch. Do I need to remain in control by setting a rule in case there's another disaster? Is the vertical gap the steel rule of family silence? Or is the gap a breathing space for me to exercise my freedom of expression? I've just started making small drawings about the cemetery, and I'm about to travel to Lee in Staffordshire to visit the farm where my mother was born, and to meet Jean, a neighbour, who grew up with my mother and called her Tiny. That's it. You're going to read.
Well, I'm going to be standing.
And I'm going to come, I think, come down for a bit.
Yeah.
And then you can read.
Because otherwise we could. I'm going to stand up if that's all right. Can you hear me? Is it echoing? Sounds echoing to me. Is it okay? Well, that was really, fascinating. I've seen some of Faye's pictures before, but there was a lot there that I didn't know, and a lot that is very familiar to me. Amazing how these experiences often are run in parallel. And I don't have any pictures to show you, I'm afraid, and I won't be able to give you the whole, I could read you the whole book. That would be the only way I could do it. So I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about the book, about the origins and background of the book, and then read you a passage from it. It won't give you that broad, impression that you've got from Faye, but that's the best I can do, I'm afraid. So my mother, Hannah, died about a year after Faye's it was 50 years, December 14th that she killed herself. She was 29, I was 4, my brother was 7. And as with Faye's, as Faye has described, similar thing, a silence descended on my family. My father decided it was best if we didn't talk about her, and I grew up knowing very little about her. The one person who would talk to me about her was my grandmother, who told me the same, would repeat to me the same dozen or so stories about her childhood mischiefs and adventures, how she locked a neighbour in the chicken shed until she promised to stop hitting her son, who was my mother's friend, how she had an affair, as she put it, with her headmaster when she was 15, how she wanted to marry my father at 17, but they made her wait until she was 18. My grandparents also had a couple of photographs and of my mother on display, and on their wall a big drawing of her. But in my own house, as with Faye again, there were no pictures, photographs of her on display, no evidence of her existence really, except the one thing that my father did keep and kept on up on a high bookshelf were some copies of her book. And she had written, before she died, a book called The Captive Wife, which was a sociological study of the conflicts of young mothers. And it was published posthumously. And my father put these books up on a high shelf. Nobody told me about them, but I discovered them at some point, and I would sneak a look at them when I could. And my father spoke to me about her once in all my childhood years. He took me for a drive, I think so that he didn't have to look at me while he was speaking. And he told me that her death hadn't been heart attack, as I had been told, but suicide. And he gave me the brief facts that she had fallen in love with a colleague at the art college where she was teaching, that he, as he put it, had turned out to be homosexual, and he rejected her, and she felt she'd messed everything up and killed herself. And after that, the silence pretty much closed in again, and it wasn't until I was about 30, just past the age she had been when she died, that I found out some more about her and her death. Clearing out my grandparents' house, I found a couple of items. One was a clipping from a local newspaper, a report of the inquest into her death. And from this, I learned for the first time how she died by gas, the date of her death, the place of her death, which was a flat in Primrose Hill, just around the corner from where I was at that moment. My grandparents' house was also in Primrose Hill, although it was a... To tell you something about my state of mind, that it was another 15 years before I walked that 100 yards to look at the house where she died. And it was actually also just around the corner from where Sylvia Plath had killed herself in the same way 2 years earlier. And I say that mostly to draw a distinction, which was that unlike Plath, Hannah, my mother, she had no history of mental illness or depression or suicide attempts. And in fact, the article that I found that day records the coroner at the inquest saying that in the 1,700 cases of suicide over which he had presided, he had never come across one in which the intent to take one's own life had been clearer, but he had been so confused as to the reason. The other thing I found that day was her suicide note. And no one had told me that she'd written a suicide note, but I knew immediately what it was. It was written, scrawled really, on both sides of a small white envelope. And at the bottom, at the bottom of the front, she'd written PTO, as if whoever found it wouldn't think to turn it over. And on the back, she'd written, "Please tell the boys I did love them terribly." And again, it will show you, you know, probably for many of you, it's hard to understand what we're talking about, that didn't change the silence at all, even long into our adult years. But I took that note with me, but I never showed it to my brother. And it wasn't that I was keeping it from him, but I felt embarrassed, ashamed to have that note. I felt like I was doing something wrong by seeing it, by possessing it, and I hid it away. And my brother died a decade or so later of a heart attack, never having seen that message that was, you know, the one thing that our mother left for us. And that, my brother's death was what precipitated me, as with Faye, her father's death, onto the road towards my mother. The feelings that were stirred up in me by my brother's death grew in time into a need, a desire, eventually an obsession to find out more about who my mother was and why she killed herself. So I'm going to read you a passage from the book. It's towards the end of the book. And during my researches, I set out to find as much out as I could. This was in some ways, I mean, we can talk about it later. It felt less an artistic journey than a sort of detective story, really. And I tracked down and spoke to about 70 people who'd known my mother. And one of the last I spoke to was the man with whom she'd had her affair at the end of her life. And they were teaching together at Hornsey College of Art. And it's probably worth saying that Hornsey wasn't a very rigorous place academically, and my mother was trying to get a job as a sociologist at the LSE. At that point, she had an interview in which she was rejected for the job, apparently because she was wearing too much eye makeup. Different times, hopefully. But Hornsey wasn't, as I said, very rigorous academically, but it was very much a sort of cutting edge of the 1960s. The art colleges were the epicenters of the swinging, the just emerging at that moment, swinging 60s. And the air at Hornsey, you know, the Rolling Stones were playing in the bar, the air was full of radical and exciting new ideas politically, socially. And I guess the other thing I should say is that Anne Wilkes was a friend of my mother's who let her use her flat to meet her lover, whose name was John Hayes. I'm going to see whether I can do this without my glasses, but I might need them. Yeah, I'm going to need them. I have had John Hayes's telephone number for a year now, without finding the courage to call him. He still lives, the person who gave me the number told me, with the man he was living with when he was seeing Hannah, who is also called John. The two Johns, she calls them. Not for the first time I sit with a number and a phone in front of me. Even this makes me nervous. This is the man who had an affair with my mother, cuckolded my father, over whom she killed herself. It is mid-morning. He is probably out, I tell myself. What if I just dial, listen to his voice on the answer machine? I watch my finger move from one key to the next. Listen to the echo of the rings. One, two. Before I can hang up, a man's voice answers, says that he is John. I panic. Which John is this? I'm looking for John Hayes, I say. This is John Hayes. The voice is softer, posher, more velvety than I have imagined. Though what I have imagined, I do not know. Only not this. Perhaps not anything. Is that me? I could still hang up, but I do not. I explain as well as I can, my hands shaking, who I am, what I want. And the velvety voice responds slowly, calmly. Yes, he will see me, he says. He suggests we meet next week at the Charing Cross Hotel in the upstairs cafe. An hour later, he calls back. There is a tremor in his voice now. He has been disturbed by my phone call, he says. We should meet sooner, tomorrow, the same place. I hardly sleep. I arrive early at the hotel and I go upstairs, but there is a function in the cafe, so it is closed to the general public. I come down to the lobby and walk up and down until I realize that I have twice, three times, walked past a man hunched in a scarf and coat, in a chair, in an alcove. I look at him. He looks at me. John? Yes. He stands up, we shake hands, he is smaller than I imagined. In my mind, he has always been tall. He is older, too. I was looking, I realized, for a young man, though he is no older than his age. White hair, a squarish face, watery blue eyes. In an email later, he will tell me that he, too, hardly slept the previous night. We sit, perhaps we discuss drinks, order them. I do not remember. I explain again my need to know about Hannah. He will answer any questions, he says, though when I ask if I can take notes, he looks alarmed. Better not, he says. His voice seems less velvety in person, more pained, kindlier. I suggest we start at the beginning, his first meeting with Hannah, and he says it was 1964, no, 65, what year was it, he says, fumbling over his words. I help him. Does it need to be a bit further? Okay. It's my movement, is it? It's my heart beating. What?
You're really high. Yeah, exactly.
Help, Sandman. It was just off-putting to me.
Something.
That's better. Okay, sorry about that. I've probably forgotten where I was. Okay. I help him work out the date, my journalist self taking over. It was the autumn of 1964. What was his impression of Hannah, I ask? She was the princess of the college, he says. I have to write that down, I say. And he says, okay, and from here on I take notes. What does he mean by princess, I ask? One, she was beautiful now. Sorry, can you still hear me? Okay, sorry. One, she was beautiful. And two, she had an intense clarity of mind that burned like the sun, he says. She quickly established herself as the leading member of our group and put others in the shade. He is more confident now, and he talks with a quiet staccato eloquence about Hornsey, how the general studies course was new, how he and Hannah and others were forging it together, would have discussions, arguments. He and Hannah were quite antagonistic to each other at first, belligerent even. He was a grammar school boy who had been to Oxford to study philosophy, he says, so he was quite confident himself, quite bright and brash. Hannah and I were the children, 28, 29, the youngest in the department, he says. The belligerence grew into affection. I have to understand the times, he says. There was an effervescence in the air, a feeling that we could do things. Britain itself seemed at that moment capable of creating a dynamic new culture, cinema, theatre. Hannah and I were drunk on this metaphorically, and it created an alliance between us. It was an uneasy alliance at first. Hannah used to drop in halfway through my lectures and sit at the back and make herself conspicuous, as was her style. The first time this happened, I said, "What are you doing snooping on my lecture?" And she said, "I want to see what you're like. You're new. Are you any good?" He remembers one occasion. We were interviewing candidates, students, and she said I should start. So I asked this schoolboy whether he thought flowers could feel pain. I wanted to ask him something he wouldn't be prepared for, and Hannah snorted. I ignored her, asked my questions, and she asked hers, but at the break I asked her why she'd been so ill-mannered, and she said I was being so Oxford and pompous. They laughed. The ice was broken. He and the other John met at Oxford and had been together for 10 years by the time he met Hannah. They had both had affairs, but he had never slept with a woman before Hannah, and has never done so since. So why her, I ask? I was intoxicated by her combination of beauty and clarity and candor. He had always been attracted intellectually, emotionally to women, but with Hannah there was a physical intensity, a passion that intrigued him. Hannah made the runnings, set up their meetings in Anne Wicks's flat, though they only met there 3 or 4 times in total. "That step to me was a step I shouldn't have taken," he says. What he cared about was the wonderful mutuality they had with each other, the excited intellectual talk. We were in a highly combustible state in our excitement over ideas. We had the feeling that what we talked about mattered. But once they had taken the step into bed, Hannah started getting more serious. He didn't know that my father had moved out, and when he did, John was morally disturbed. He came from a small rural community in Lancashire and had a very ethical system of living. He was pulled along by Hannah. But after a time, I felt I didn't want to go any further, and I began to pull back. They had arranged to meet on the afternoon of Hannah's death at Anne Wicks's flat, but he rang her the night before or that morning to say he wasn't coming, that they had to stop. She said, "I'll still be there if you change your mind." He had a 6 o'clock lecture, but afterwards he decided he wasn't dealing with this in the proper manner and that he needed to talk to her face to face. I went to Chalk Farm Station, and when I got out, I thought I'd ring the flat to see if she was there, but I got no reply. I called her home, and your father answered and said she was dead. Anne Wicks had told my grandfather that she had found John on her steps. This might be true, he says, but he has no memory of it. He knows that he eventually went home that night. The other John knew about Hannah, so he was able to tell him what had happened, but they never talked about it. I ask why. You carry on with life. He has often thought about it, though. In trying to come to terms with it, he says, I came to believe that she'd embarked upon something and it hadn't worked. I think of my own stupidity, carelessness, he says, shaking his head sadly. Of Hannah's personality, he says, aut Caesar, aut nihil, either Caesar or nothing. She wanted clarity, he says. She couldn't live with imperfection, compromise. Later, typing up my notes, I think about this. How we have all had to live with the compromises she left for us. He has had close women friends since Hannah, though never quite like Hannah, and never anything sexual. He mentions the novelist Angela Carter and the publisher Carmen Khalil, an old friend of my father's. Did he ever talk to Carmen about Hannah? This is the first time he has ever spoken of her, he says. We have both spent much of the conversation in tears, and his cheeks are wet now. She is always there in my mind, he says. The ghost comes back. Thank you. Shall I move this across?
Thank you so much, both of you, for these very moving creative expressions of what somehow two losses, which are so very different but also have many similarities. And I understand you have talked together a little bit about that. And what came to mind about that?
I bumped into Jeremy's partner at the local cash point. We happened to live near each other. Around the time my dad died. And I said, you know, how are you? Well, how's Jeremy? Oh, he's on this search for his mother. And I said, oh my God, so am I. So I knew Jeremy was on a parallel journey. And I think what's interesting about our discussions for me is that there are so many common points, but also that Jeremy and I are doing something quite different. I'm creating, you know, drawings, and Jeremy has been investigating and documenting his mother in a way. So we can talk about these things, but what really struck me, I think, when I first opened Jeremy's book was this extraordinary quote that he starts the book off with, which I'd like to read to you. And maybe we could just start there. It's a quote from Amos Oz. And he shared it with me, in fact, at the time of my opening, because I was so worried about putting my mother on show. And the quote is, "Have I betrayed them all again by telling the story? Or is it the other way round? Would I have betrayed them if I had not told it?" And I wanted to ask Jeremy why he began the book with this particular quote.
Well, I think I was trying to protect myself. I still feel guilty sitting here that I'm doing something wrong. I mean, I know that intellectually I'm not. I understand that, but I still can't shake off this feeling that I'm doing something wrong by sitting here, by talking to you about, by breaking this taboo. And it was a sort of, it was a protection. My father was still alive when I was writing the book. And although he helped me as best he could, I knew he didn't really want me to be doing it. So it was partly a protection, a sort of statement to him. But it was much broader than that. It was to the world, which is what I felt that I was, I was sort of challenging some rule of life. That's really what it was. Just self-protection. And also, in a way, sort of stating that while I felt that, I did believe that what I was doing, that I had a right to be doing what I was doing. And I think it was very important, one of the things that was very important for me, and I sort of be interested what you've got to say, Faye, about this, because, I think there's something very different about doing this with words and doing it with art. I'm engaging with it on a very sort of factual, intellectual basis. Obviously, there's lots of emotion involved. I've sort of lost my line of thought, but I mean, did you feel also that you were sort of needing to, that you were breaking rules even by doing your art?
Yes, definitely. And I, like you, I feel I'm, even now, I feel there's an element of being disloyal to my father, which I think is absolutely ridiculous, given that all I'm doing is reclaiming my mother. But this rule, this family rule of silence, has lived with me all my life. And I am totally conditioned by it. Even though I know rationally, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Although we're conditioned by it in response to this one thing. I don't know. I am. I mean, I'm someone. And what's really weird for me is that I'm someone who challenges everything. It doesn't take no for an answer. I'm skeptical. And yet this one thing I never challenge. Or it took me sort of, three quarters of a life before I could challenge it. One thing I was interested in to sort of talk about is, how have you been with your children in terms of talking to them about telling them truths and stuff? Has that been difficult for you, or did that come next?
Well, I've told my children about my mother very freely, and I always have done.
Have you told them about yourself? Sorry.
Hmm?
Have you told them about yourself?
In what sense?
Oh, just in the same freeway.
They know. Oh, they know about the silence around the mother, because we've discussed it. But it's very difficult, I think, to understand that unless you're the person. It's such an weird. And I was thinking, why has this happened? And my mother died very very suddenly. It was about survival. We needed to move on. We needed to survive. I wanted to be loyal to my father. I thought that if I showed any, maybe if I started crying in front of him or mentioned my mother, that the world would collapse. I mean, literally, everything would just come tumbling down. And I felt that, that I had to support him. And also, he was telling me this is the way, and he was my teacher, and I was only seven. Therefore, I thought, well, this is normal. And then it becomes the normal. And I think you don't...
It's the power of the
family dynamic,
yeah,
then it's very difficult to challenge. And the only time I was able to challenge it was after my father's death. Because, like Jeremy grieving for his brother, that then opened up his mother, for me,
know, when I was grieving for my father, I realized that it was going much, much deeper. And then I was finding these photographs of my mother in the family home. And something happened. I mean, I just became more curious. I mean, that was the weird thing about becoming curious. I hadn't been curious. Mm. I hadn't wanted to ask questions. You know, it was all suppressed. I'd not wanted to ask one question. How is that? How did I arrive here, age 57, not wanting to ask questions about my mother until my father's death in 2009? I find it extraordinary now, looking back.
You told me that not only did you find pictures of your mother when you looked through your father's house, but you also found very intimate memorabilia, like the powder, a lemon which he kept, which would think that he actually needed a connection to his dead wife. And I was wondering if maybe seeing that, the more you found, the more you realize he didn't ban her, at least not her things, from his mind. You found them on hidden places and some were exhibited. And if that gave you somewhat more, you were allowance, or you were allowed to go there. Not only that he wasn't there to hold you back. Because as you also explained to me, your father seemed to have been a very loving, loving man who took over the maternal...
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my father was the most brilliant mother and the most brilliant father. I mean, he did everything. We didn't have a nanny. We didn't have... You know, we had... I think we had a cleaner who came once a fortnight on a Thursday morning to do some very basic stuff, and that was it. I mean, my dad did everything. You know, it was making breakfast, making supper, washing up. You know, we all mucked in, but basically he did everything. He went and collected us from school. I mean, it was amazing what he was doing. And, of course, he was working at home, so luckily he could write and do all of this as well. But what he did was extraordinary, and he loved me very, very much, and I loved him very, very much. But going back over what you said, yes, in his study, there were photographs of my mother on a small chair that I remember my mother and father buying in a local house sale somewhere, and I'd gone along as well. Now, I had no idea those photographs were there, even though I'd lived in the house all my life. I found this wonderful gold compact on his writing desk, which, thanks to the internet, I dated around to the early 1960s. And I do remember my mother having a gold compact. I can only assume it was hers. And yes, what a wonderful, intimate object to keep. I mean, it's extraordinary. And then the other objects you refer to, the lemon, for example. In my father's house, there are some things that always seems to... They've been there forever. A dried-up lemon that went onto the nursery mantelpiece when I was about 12, it was still there in 2009, with a beautiful, just a little film of dust on it. My brother's flipper was holding open the door of the nursery. It had been there, again, since I was about 12. So these two items that had been there for such a long time were after my mother's death. Right. But yes, they're objects which of course, do relate to my childhood. That's absolutely true. But it's interesting, as my father got worse and worse, he had prostate cancer, and, of course, he knew he was going to die. He knew he had about 5 years to live. And in the last few the last 9 months, 6 months, he moved in with his girlfriend, Claire, and he and I used to go down to Shepperton in the car every fortnight just to pick up the post, you know, all those sorts of things you have to do. But it gave us an opportunity to walk around the house and look for things. I remember going into his bedroom where he'd kept some of his manuscripts and they were out ready. And he said, you know, darling, you know, you must do the right thing with these. And I said, oh, Daddy, what about the cupboard, the bedroom cupboard, your bedroom cupboard? I said, I remember you used to put some of your first editions in there because
you know, the journalists who'd go downstairs and interview in your study would sometimes nick books. And this was a good place to keep the, you know, the copies. And he just turned to me and said, "Oh, I wouldn't go in the cupboard now, darling. You know, in time, you know, you'll do that." And it's in that cupboard that, of course, I found the slides of this holiday, the Alicante holiday, 1964. And I found, you know, my bed blankets that I've researched and come from my mother's family in that cupboard as well. So yes, maybe he was saying, in a way, "I'm leaving this to you, and you will find," and whatever. I just don't know, because I was never able to ask him. I wish it was just impossible. And the only other thing, and I mustn't hog this, the only other thing to say is that my father, when he was dying, wrote Miracles of Life, his biography, which he dedicated to his three children. And I found it very poignant. There was a small chapter on my mother, which gave some facts. And I wondered too whether, you know, that was his way of saying, you know, this is some information about your mother. You do need it at some point in your life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, and that's quite different.
Well, I was thinking about. I mean, you're talking about how. I mean, for you, how you didn't. You know, you couldn't challenge. You didn't ask any questions. Yet I asked you the other day whether, because for me, you know, I've come to feel now that I became a writer to write this story. That, you know, I think if you grow up as a child with a great hidden story in your life, you know, and you become a writer, surely that's the story you become a writer to write. Wow. That's what drives you. And I, looking back now, and I look at the various books I've written, I can see that in some ways all of them I was sort of circling around my mother. My first novel ended with a mother's suicide. I thought, oh, this is nothing to do with me. It's just a coincidence that I'm writing. I mean, literally, this is how I was thinking. Later, my next two novels were both fragmented novels. They were nothing to do with my mother's story, but they were in a way addressing this, addressing this fragmented story that I had. I had these just few fragments about my mother that I was, you know, in my mind had tried to put together into a story, not very successfully. And I was writing novels that were constructed out of fragments. So I think in form I was trying to approach my mother's subject. And I said to you the other day, I said, do you think that you became an artist? Because Faye, took up art about, what, 15 years ago. Mm. You know, did you do that? Do you think now that you did that effectively to get towards your mother to, and you said, no, you don't think you did initially. And then yet everything that you've, you know, the woman without the face, the, you know, your fragmented drawings. I mean, it seemed to me looking at those drawings that they were all, you know, and you said to me that your first drawing was about a coffin.
I think, obviously consciously you didn't do it, but then the first thing you did was a coffin.
Yes, I mean, it's so messy, isn't it? I mean, there are no simple answers to any of this. But when I left my job and wanted to retrain and go back to drawing, which of course is what I really loved, I didn't know that I was really on a search for my mother. It's a bit like your early work, Jeremy. I mean, you know, fragmented novels about a woman who's searching. I mean, you didn't necessarily know
consciously
what you were doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think I did either. The only thing I would say is, that I didn't mention today is this coffin. I went to the City Lit and did a half-day course in sculpture, because I didn't know whether I wanted to do sculpture or what I wanted to do. And anyway, did some sculpture. And the first thing, we were asked to make something that very afternoon with paper. And I chose to make a life-size paper coffin in which I put these little sort of objects, you know, a little bit of Hessian, a little bit of, I don't know, ribbon, a bit, I don't know what things were. And I was just staggered that I'd made this coffin. I thought, Jesus, what on earth? What am I doing? You know, is this a boat? Is this a coffin? What is this? And I remember coming home and my husband who's sitting there, I remember him saying to him, you know, I just made this coffin, God. And I think he said, you know, well, maybe it's about your mother. You know, and I was quite shocked. You know, I was so out of touch with it.
We're out of touch. We both managed to marry therapists.
Yes, that's very, but isn't that interesting? Yeah. But I want to ask Jeremy something, which is about when you're working. You know, when I'm working, the actual act of creativity, you know, when I'm actually working, feels for me a very safe zone. Because I go into a sort of reverie, I don't know, I call it a reverie, but some sort of, it's a bit like daydreaming, but I'm miles away in the drawing. And then I come out into the real world, and then I have to address issues like, well, you know, one day would you like to show these drawings? And then something else happens completely, which is that I get really worried, and I think, oh God, you know, am I being disloyal again? All that sort of stuff. And I wanted to ask Jeremy, do you feel the same, do you feel creativity is a safe zone?
Well, yeah, I mean, looking at your pictures, I can understand that. I don't think it was the same for me. I think there's an element of that, I mean, when you get lost in the work. But it was this particular book was such a, I mean, it's just different when you're dealing with words and you're dealing with the story. And you were in a way, I mean, after I found that the newspaper cutting and my mother's suicide note when I was in my early 30s, I wrote a series of poems that were in a way comparable to some of your drawings in that they weren't about my mother, they were really about my response to not knowing about her and to her absence. But this book, I set out, I think, you know, once I started realized that I was going to try and write a book, even before that probably, I said there's no point doing this unless I try to find out the truth as much as one can, find out the truth as much as there is an objective truth. You know, having lived so long with lies, half-truths, evasions, I said, right, I'm going to treat this sort of in a forensic way. So when you're doing a forensic project, when you're talking to people about whether your mother was abused by her headmaster or it was a love affair, things like that, you know, it's not a safe place. These are dangerous places to go.
Yeah.
And it was a very kind of emotional roller coaster to finding out all these details about all these different aspects of my mother's life, about my grandparents, my father, you know, our family life. So, you know, I think there are times there where I would have loved to have been better at drawing and to be able to have drawn it and in a way to have sort of bypassed the intellectual, gone straight to some kind of emotional, I don't know, you know, I'm not an artist, so I can't really explain that, but I think it's anyway.
I think, all people have different ways to express themselves creatively. Is it more in an investigative style? You were a reporter before you started to write in more fictional way. It is something different, but you had to get in some way to this mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and both had a trigger for it.
Mm-hmm.
You had the trigger of your revered father and loved father who you couldn't even think to do something against him,
yeah.
Or you didn't want to in his older age to get him all upset.
No.
He had to die before.
Yeah.
And I think it was the loss, the sudden loss of your brother, which you said made you realize that there was more to the loss than the brother, that there was you touched a much deeper place in your psyche, which then gave you the strength, or it was a necessity actually to go there.
Yeah.
And I think when today it's a little more uncommon that losses are not addressed. Many people now know that it is extremely helpful for children, any age and adults, to look at the personal loss, to be sent to a therapist or to a grieving group, that the family has to speak about it. Often children are invited to make pictures about it because they don't know it consciously when they're very little. Or they, one gives them toys to play it out. It was the beginning of this knowledge at the time when your parents passed away. But when this is not done, when it's avoided or denied or split off, then it's not split off of the individual psyche. It rests somewhere inside. Mm. And one of the theorists calls it, it's like an exquisite corpse, which is inside, encrypted in your soul. Mm. So it's like in a coffin in the soul. And it needs a trigger to allow the work needed to get to open that crypt.
And it's like the monster in Alien.
Yes, exactly. And to stare it in the eye with all the comforting and with all the upsetting news that come out. And artists have, I guess, a particular tool which they might be able to reach that. And often hand in hand, like I said earlier with Jane, sometimes that's not good enough and they need to have spouse psychotherapist or they have to go to a psychoanalyst to help it along and others don't.
But I guess what interests me is this question of whether, I mean, there's been quite a lot of work done on powerful people having had lost a parent. American presidents, prime ministers have often lost a parent when young. I wonder whether it's often a father, but what I was thinking was whether the loss is part of what turned us into creative, for me to be a writer, Faye to be an artist or whatever. Whether it's not simply that we're lucky enough to have a way to express this, but whether actually that the death partly formed us, our life was shaped.
The choice of expression also.
Yeah.
Yes,
we couldn't tell that story, so we would tell other stories, or we couldn't
paint
that picture, so we would paint other pictures.
I do believe that is very likely.
Is there anyone here who's come because they've lost a parent when young? And has anyone managed to find ways to express it?
I haven't lost a parent, but I lost a sister 49 years ago this weekend. My sister was the older sister. She was 21, I was 11. And I found what you both said absolutely so powerful, because I am exactly the same, but it was never spoken of in my family, ever. My parents, to their dying days, we could not discuss it with them. And your point about feeling it was a sense of disloyalty, even to kind of raise the question of my sister Judith, was very powerful. Sadly, I can neither draw nor write, so I've not been able to kind of express it creatively. But what I have found that I think is quite interesting as well, as I have got older, after not having spoken of it for literally decades, and occasionally I would be able to discuss it with members of my family and my other elder sisters. But a bit like some of the comments you both made, those stories were never quite helpful, I found. I mean, I never really got to the real person. But what I have found more recently is that I have wanted to tell other people that I've lost a sister. And it's an incredibly important part of me. I think the one thing I do find is it's a very powerful thing to tell people. If you find yourself sharing it, you suddenly find the whole relationship with people changes. And I've just been thinking as you've been speaking, I had a big birthday party recently, and I found myself standing up in front of 100 of my friends, showing a picture of my sister Judith, and saying, when I was 11, my sister died. And three-quarters of my friends had no knowledge of that, but I needed them to know something. So I think it's interesting, it may be a maturity thing, and you reach a certain age when you need to explore this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a sister, not a parent, so it's obviously a very different relationship, but nonetheless, the whole family dynamic, I think, is quite similar.
Can I just say I've actually connected with both of you and was totally in tears about it, because the silence just nearly killed me. And it was the searching for my father. And I've always felt that there was a secret. Why wasn't I told? I couldn't understand how he named me after his mother. And my mother refused to talk about him. yet they were married. And he moved on. I'm half Lebanese. My mother's Ghanaian. So it was the search, and I kept on searching and searching. I find that the silence was just, I couldn't handle the silence as I kept on asking questions. And it, the questions that I needed that fulfillment in me. You talked about a coffin, and it's like, I don't know whether your husband or your wife knows about rescuing the inner child by Penny Parks. And there's a drawing of an adult, and inside there's the inner child wanting answers, wanting to be rescued. Mm-hmm. And I learnt that so many, and I find that I love drawing, and I've been able to express myself through typing, writing. And it's really helped me to actually listen. And it's just the secret of not talking. Mm-hmm. And you drew a face, or was it, I don't know who it was. There's a face, but with me, I always drew myself with a face, eyes, nose, but no lips. And I wasn't able to talk about what I suffered, what I went through as a child. I was born in 63. So what I suffered as a child without my parents being in the same country. And what I went through, my mother didn't want to hear. And I felt guilty. I felt that going through counselling, I didn't want to talk about my mother because I felt I was being disloyal to her, even though she had left me before I was 3 and I didn't know her until I was 8 and a half. I didn't even recognize her. So when you suffer through that trauma and be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, you lose and you try to connect. And I felt so ashamed of what happened to me, which wasn't my fault. I felt so ashamed that there was it wasn't even a wall. It was like this metal, heavy.
Well, it sounds like, again, there's just many, these are shared experiences.
Yeah, it's very sad.
Listen, it's my fault. I think there's a time for questions and I sort of leapt out. So can we hold other thoughts until
I just wanted to point something out, which you mentioned, that often it needs a trigger. That a little bit like the artist I mentioned earlier, whose lover was dying, and that triggered him to work through his early losses. And I think your brother dying made you, the grief led you to your mother, who was so far down but always present in her not being there. And that a lot of people can not access with help, and yeah. That is the difficulties. And you know, I don't know how it was in England in the 60s, but the understanding of trying to help people grieve of any age, a 1-year-old needs to grieve. Is today so much more understood and brought forward. And as you said, you know, even one can express it through so many ways. And then often one needs to work through it deeply also with another person, be it in a psychotherapy or in any kind of an exchange.
Or through art, yes.
There's a question I wanted to ask you, Faye. I mean, you know, I've known you a while. Do you think it's changed you, this process, as a person? Do you think you know, are there ways in which you've changed, you know, because obviously, you know, here we were as kids, we weren't allowed to grieve, as Esther's saying, so we held it in, the alien monster or the whatever you would, you know, and now it's out. Has that changed? Do you feel that's changed you?
Yes, I do. I think I feel... I used to feel as if I had a hollow in my stomach or I was only on one leg. And now I feel I've got definitely standing on 2 legs. I feel much more unified, much more balanced as a person. And I'm much more curious. I think I'm beginning to think in a way I never used to think. And I'm noticing that all the time. And I think the final thing I would say, and I was thinking about this in relation to a friend who's here, I used to feel always that I was, you know, I had to be the survivor. Everything was fine. I didn't need any help. I was going to be fine, always. And I've noticed recently that I'm able to say to my friends, actually, I'm not feeling great, I've got this, I've got that, you know, I can be more vulnerable. I'm allowing myself to be more vulnerable. And I think that's a great step forward. What about you?
Yeah, I think, I think that process was a long process for me. You know, and I think I've been writing longer than you. But I feel, I wish, in some ways I wish, you know, I think this idea of, you know, this idea of closure, you know, I wish I felt more of that. I think it's a, you know, it's helped a lot to go through this process, but I don't think I don't think it's sort of finished. But yeah, I think it has. It's made me feel, I think, more complete as a person. I think there was a part of me that was, as you were talking about, this part that was sort of hidden or unexpressed. And I feel sort of calmer and more solid. I feel that I can sort of, in a way what you were saying, I feel I can face challenges with sort of more equanimity now, or not worrying so much about things going wrong. I think perhaps.
I'm glad to hear that.
Good.
Because I do believe art is one of the most artistic expression of any kind, is the most powerful.
Well, you're an art therapist, sure. So you would believe that. But I'm not saying it's not true.
And is one ever fully done? That's the other question.
Well, it's like, is there a book ever fully written?
Yeah.
How are we doing on?
We've got a half full, and we said we'd have sort of final questions and things. So I think we could, I wonder whether Jane actually might join you as well on the platform, and then we could have some general questions and answers.
Yes.
About the whole process and everything that has been talked about. I mean, not to shut off this discussion.
No, absolutely.
And then just have kind of 20 minutes of question and answer, and then...
Yeah.
There isn't another mic, so you might just have to talk loudly. Yeah. Okay. So maybe it's just some questions from the floor.
Yes, please.
I'm wondering, in the morning, it's kind of very often seen as a very kind of personal and private journey, but your art is publicly shared, and how do you feel about that? Does the sharing kind of come from the need to share the art, or to share the morning? I mean, there's been a lot of touch on sharing on the morning, kind of the public participation in your very private acts of great pain and loss.
For me, it's so important to voice. I've been silent all my life. I am going to voice this forever, and that's what I really care about. If I can engage with people and open a dialogue up and talk about this stuff like we are now, that's fantastic. But the most important thing for me is voicing.
Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it has lots of functions for me, I think, the voicing. I think it's saying what was not being allowed to say before, I think, was important. I think for me also, bringing my mother back from the dead in some ways, giving her voice to some extent again. And then also, I think as children we were denied, our voice was denied, our needs were denied in a way by the decisions that were made. And so I think it was very important for me that this book wasn't just written but was published, and that my, you know, my version of the story, the fact that I'm allowed to talk about it is validated by the publication.
Yes, I'd like to add to Jeremy. I totally agree about reclaiming my mother, making her visible. Really important. You know, she's no longer invisible. She's here.
I mean, I just think that you know, you're talking about the different times, and I think in some ways, I think there were all these people who, you know, people who died young or committed suicide young back in the day, who then disappeared. Mm-hmm. And now we're in a way, we're sort of reclaiming a kind of generation who were lost, not just whose lives were lost, but whose lives were foreshortened, but whose lives were sort of lost by their early death. So it's a sort of an act of archaeology, of a sort of section of of humanity who were sort of forgotten in a way, I feel.
Can I just ask you, Faye? I mean, you probably, Faye, already said this, and I missed it. How did your mother die?
Pneumonia.
Well, you drew these leaves, these cabbage leaves, like lungs. I thought these are lungs.
Yeah.
Full of the lungs, the breathing, the suffocation, you know, the leaves. You said you didn't draw your mother originally, but you did with the leaves, you know. That's what I thought. I needed desperately to know if it was with her lungs she died. Mm. Yeah.
Just an association to you, Jeremy. You know, Sigmund Freud said the psychoanalysis was like an archaeologist going to dig for treasures. Yes, there in the back. Yes.
My question is to you, Esther. It's really reassuring listening to people talking about the sense of disloyalty. What do you advise to people, your clients and people you deal with, who are going through trauma and loss with a loved one who's still alive, that it's kind of defining their story, but it's not their story, even though it is their story? So, you know, I find I'm writing, but I'm not showing anyone, not even my partner, who it's largely about. Yeah. And still there's a sense of disloyalty about sort of using his trauma and his loss and his illness and my emotions around that for my own self-expression. I feel like it's necessary. I feel like it's life-giving to me. But I still feel a sense of disloyalty about it. What do you do with partners of people who are sick, who are facing severe traumas, that sort of thing?
It's all very individual in each case. I do believe, for example, I have a lot of experience with people who face cancer in different stages. And they always have families too, or children, or whatever. It's often a good idea to give different people who experience the trauma differently access to therapy or to expressing themselves. And if you have a private way to express your emotion around an illness or a loss, there is nothing disloyal about not showing that. It is something you might want to share, maybe also with a therapist, but not necessarily. If it's good enough for you to work through it like that. But it might be not the right thing to share it with the partner, because this is your feeling working through with yourself, but maybe with a partner in therapy. And maybe you would like to encourage the partner who goes through that trauma in a different way to seek help in doing that too. And the other possibility, when you really feel that you would like to share what you did with your partner, it would relieve you in some sense, then you might want to have a mediator in there, maybe a couple therapist or somebody who can embrace both of you and help both of you to understand each other through your artistic expression. But it's not disloyal not to share your innermost working through process, even if it's creatively or only creatively or in a therapeutic way to your partner. Maybe we have other opinions here. We have a lot of therapists. Yes.
I'm not a therapist. I have a question for Jeremy. When you were giving us the introduction to your mother, I felt like I was suffocating. And then when you were reading from your book, I could feel myself starting to breathe. So my question is, how old were you when you were told the truth about your mother?
16.
Was that a huge shock? Did you have a feeling of suffocation at that moment when you heard the truth?
So I'm just curious, why do you think it made you feel suffocating?
I just put myself in that situation and I just became very emotional.
I don't really remember it well enough to. I mean, what I. It's actually really interesting because you're saying that because a couple of things come to mind. What it makes me actually think about, because my first memory, I have no memory of my mother at all. I can't access anything to do with her. My first memory is the day after she died, when my father sat my brother and me down to tell us that she was dead. I've tried to write down that scene several times. I sort of write about it a bit in the book, but what I remember about it is how, I can't remember his words, but I can remember how the knowledge of what he was saying sort of seemed to fill the room. It seemed to kind of become a kind of almost a solid object that was filling every space in the room, which I guess is perhaps something similar to what you're describing. The time that my father told me when I was 16 in his car, I think I felt something similar in a way. I certainly remember not knowing whether I should be crying or whether I could cry, and worrying about what he thought I would feel, and not asking. I certainly didn't ask any questions. I didn't talk to anyone about it for years afterwards. I don't know if that.
Did you feel any anger towards your mother?
Well, that's a question I'm always being asked. Not really, no. I've never really felt any, momentarily when I found out that she'd had another affair, before I was born, giving away the end of the book. But not really ever. I haven't, no.
I have a question for you as well, because you say you have no memories of your mother, and yet your language is your art. You paint such a vivid picture of this. And for me, when I read the book, I really felt like I knew her, in the sense that she became so alive. And it was just, the picture was vivid.
Well,
I wondered, my question is, whether through finding out about her and through writing about her, whether you see yourself reflected in her, whether you understand things about yourself that you didn't know you got from her.
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things. One, yet absolutely, I do. I mean, I feel I know myself better. I feel I know my children better. I've got two daughters. The first girl's born in the family since my mother died. I feel I know my brother. You know, I feel I know through studying her, I've learned a lot about myself and my family, and a lot more about her. But what I don't feel, which is frustrating, is, you know, I wondered whether the process might bring up a memory or some memories. It hasn't. And I don't, what's sad to me is, in a way, how I feel about it is that I feel I know her in a way that a biographer would know their subject very intimately, very well, and better in some ways than you know other people. Yet I don't have that felt connection. Many things about the whole process make me feel very, very deeply. I wept many a time during the process, but I never felt, I still haven't felt that. You know, when you, you have a few memories of your mother.
Yeah.
Does that give you, do you think, a connection to her, even if it's only a few memories, a physical, felt, sort of visceral connection to her? Because that's what I'm missing with my mother.
Yes, I definitely feel it.
So she's someone you know in one way or another.
But it's fragmented, of course. Yeah. It's the side of her hip. It's the cheek in the sunlight. It's just little fragments.
And a feel of her personality. Do you have
warm, a bit extrovert, I think. But I can't say more than that. Mm. And she cuddled me a lot, so maternal.
Do you remember that?
But I don't remember her voice, and I think that's a great pity.
Yeah, voice. I've got film, I've got letters, I've got that track, but that voice, I mean, she did radio and television, and I've tried to get people at the BBC to do it, so I have no voice. So that's, you know, that loss of voice is a big loss, isn't it?
Huge, yeah.
Somebody at the back.
Yeah, the back, who's had his hands up.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm back from Canada, and right now, before the Parliament of Canada, there's a great debate about medical assisted suicide. And so here we are at the Freud Center, with Freud having had medical assisted suicide. And I guess I wondered, Jeremy, whether the suicide was a particular element in terms of motivating you to write the book, and whether it would make any difference if her death was from, as it were, natural causes.
Well, I think maybe we should direct that to Faye, because it certainly was for me. you know, the fact to solve that problem, you know, part of what I was set out to do was to know my mother, but also to try and understand why she did what she did. Yet Faye's been propelled onto a similar course without it being suicide. So, I mean, Faye, you know, was do you think that it made any difference that your mother didn't, you know, that she died naturally? It's still that need to know. I think, to me, it's the silence that descended afterwards that is that obviously, you know, if you're looking at the both of us having this great urge, need, it's because we were denied knowledge. I think it's perhaps the fundamental thing. The suicide is almost secondary to that. What do you think, Faye?
I agree.
And may I add something? Naturally assisted suicide, as it is discussed in the state of California right now and in Canada, is a whole different story. And you bring up Freud, but this is a whole different story. It's meant for people who are dying and suffering and, like Freud for many, many years was intensely suffering. And in the last moment, he couldn't take it anymore. So it's kind of a different type of thing. It's a kind of a decision thing, you know.
Well, just to add to the complexity of the complex problem that's facing Canada, the Alberta Court of Appeal, which is one of the provinces of Canada, the highest court of the land, last week in a unanimous decision of three judges of the Court of Appeal in interpreting that, said that psychogenic conversion is grounds for medically assisted suicide. So the issue about death and how the complexity of it is more complex than sometimes what you think about in Freud with cancer, and of course I think everyone thinks of those sorts of things. But as a psychiatrist in Toronto, it becomes even more complex if you think about someone who has conversion disorder and then wants to medically assisted.
Well, I don't know what conversion disorder is, but I think that, I mean, my mother was 29, she had two young children, she had a book coming out that was to be a sort of, you know, major sensation. She had just been given a new job, she was completely in good health, she had no history of mental illness or troubles, she was obviously in despair at the moment she did it, but I'm not sure that anyone in any planet would have allowed her to have assisted suicide in that sense.
Can I just ask Faye, you were talking about memories of your mother, it's slightly going back to the previous question, but were those drawings that were all fragmented parts of doors, keyholes, little bits of staircases, all those hard surfaces, were they related to memories of your mother? You know, you talked about them in little fragments, somehow it felt...
Those memories are memories in the house where my mother lived, where we moved to Shepparton in 1960. So my mother lived there for 4 years, bringing me up there. And the house continued to have her presence, the ghost of her presence, hanging over it, even though we never discussed her. And for the last 15 years of my father's life, no one went to Shepparton. None of his family went to Shepparton. And when I went back to take him to Claire's, in fact, I walked in and that same ghost-like feeling was there. This melancholic feeling of my mother was there. It's saturated it seeps into the walls, the stair banister, the mantelpieces, it's in the carpets, it's everywhere. You can't get away from it.
I just thought it was so interesting how you drew nothing with soft surfaces. Everything was quite hard-edged, you know, and furniture rather than anything. Soft. You know, it didn't feel like the cuddling that you described.
Well, maybe what I was doing is not actually drawing my mother, but drawing the feelings that I have when I walk into that house. And maybe those feelings are rather hard-edged. You know, I'm drawing a lot of corners, a lot of door handles. Mm. You know, I suggest that maybe some of those corners are places to escape into, to get away from things. There are a lot of windows looking out.
The silence, perhaps, more than...
And then the silence.
And it's also the house of your father.
Yes.
And maybe with being the house of your father, there is a lot of ambivalence in there. Yeah. You know, and that may be the hard-edged... the combination of these feelings come together, because while he was revered and he was loved, but he also took something away from you or didn't give it back to you or something like that.
I think that if I'm thinking about my mother and softness, then it's got to be those pink watercolors where I really feel that's her and that's her skin and that's bodily fluid and that's us coming together. That's where I see her, in the pink watercolors.
Mm, beautiful.
The coffin was quite cool, and yet it was stating fact, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely.
And I think in all this there's a desire, because I've been through something similar, a desire for ownership and a desire to feel one did belong and that they belong to us as well. Mm. So it's like claiming a life that one couldn't share, but
reclaiming.
Reclaiming. Yes, yeah. We've talked a lot about reclaiming, that we're both reclaiming.
Entitled to know.
I mean, decisions, you know, we're talking about historical death, so decisions were made at that time, and we live in an age where we would make different decisions. Right. And we're going back from this age and applying a modern sensibility to an old thing and reclaiming those lost lives.
Yes.
I've got a question for Faye. I was just wondering, you talk about your work changing when your father died, and that you didn't make any work for
six months.
Yeah, I wondered if you could say a little bit more about that. You know, why did it?
I had no interest in making work at all. I just lost all sense of creativity. I mean, when my father died, I went into a huge grieving process for him, but also my mother. And then I was swept up in, you know, arranging funeral, doing the probate, and all of that. But I had absolutely no interest in making anything.
It took
me a while. And then, of course, I wanted to draw her, my mother's watch.
That's very interesting. I've recently lost my daughter, and I'm a painter. I've kind of skirted around my studio, you know, and I can do lots of things like dig the garden, and I really got into arranging the funeral and everything, and now I'm coming round, but I'm not quite there yet.
How long has it been for you?
3 months.
Yes, it's very
short time.
It makes the art seem pointless. I couldn't write for a couple of years after my brother's death, and in fact, I could only write when I started thinking that finding something important enough to compete with that.
It was too overwhelming.
And also stories, the words felt pointless to me, and stories seemed to all have the same ending.
And at the same time, it's very individual, you know, that you will feel it when you are there and you can do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it will come.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to metabolize your grief.
Yes.
Over a period of time. Yeah. And then you have to find it within yourself to create more work. You know, you have to feel, you have to recharge the batteries. You know, you have to feel you've got something you can come out with.
Yeah.
I think it will take you a while.
My question is, and it's partly about this idea of the inability to continue the creative process after a death, but also thinking about what you said earlier about how when you experience a death, that there's something that happens internally that perhaps makes you the artist or writer that you are today. And I was thinking about your mother dying in 64, and 9-10 years later your father publishes Crash.
I know.
And I wonder what thought you'd given to that.
I've thought a lot about this. I think it's absolutely fascinating. My mother dies in 1964. As you probably know, my father wrote a huge number of short stories in his life, particularly in the late 50s and 1960s. I mean, he wrote nearly 100 short stories. So he was writing a lot of short stories during the early 60s and then writing a novel. But after my mother's death, the short stories virtually stop. There are a few, but not very many. And the work changes completely. The next book that he publishes is The Atrocity Exhibition, which are these condensed novels. They're about the contemporary landscape, about car crashes, about sex, pornography. They're very violent. They're non-linear. They're fragmented. And we both raised this, you know, the word fragmented today, with my fragmented cabbage leaves and riverbeds and Jeremy's fragmented early work. The Atrocity exhibition is very fragmented. And then after that comes Crash, and it's collisions and violence.
An obsession with death.
And I mean, if you read some of my father's words about looking back over that period, he writes, I had to write Crash to exorcise my wife's death. It was as if 2 and 2 equaled 5. And it was the time at home when he was, after we came back from Spain, and he was drinking heavily, trying to look after us. Yeah, I mean, this was very, post-traumatic time for him. And then, of course, he follows that period with those hard-edged, picking up on what you're saying, those hard-edged novels, Concrete Island, High Rise, and the other one in the trilogy, I forget now. Terrible. Before moving into something much more lyrical. And I'm thinking of The Unlimited Dream Company that comes at the end of the 1970s, where he, I wonder whether he's recovering in a way, and he can face nature again and regrowth and starts writing about a paradise. And then, of course, what happens is in the early 80s, he writes Empire of the Sun about his first trauma, his childhood trauma, in Shanghai, which he wasn't able to address until 1984. But is there, if you read any of the earlier works, it's always there in the way that Jeremy and I have been describing in our work. You know, it was always there underneath the surface. If you read those books, short stories, everything is, all those Shanghai years are there.
Which gives us a good way, maybe finishing this part of this conference, that the unconscious propels you to work through in one way or another, like with your father and like we heard with Jane and with you, Jeremy, to express loss, mourning, related feelings like anger, disappointment, dejection, and much more. And I think for the artists who are sitting here, but also for people who are not used to use the arts, whatever arts they are, musical, we have an address, the dance and others, that is a good opportunity to deal with it. And since we're here to look at my book, each chapter is a different artist who deals differently with his or her loss, sometimes totally unconsciously, sometimes in a very defensive way. What is interesting, you mentioned the oceanic experience, the reverie that some artists are able, or some of us can access this reverie, this state of reverie, which helps so much in loss and mourning. And hopefully you can gain some of these some of these insights, which are related also on a theoretical level by Freud, Melanie Klein, and many others, contemporary researchers and psychoanalysts. Thank you very much for sharing your stories. Thank you.